Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. From 1692 to 1693, the New England city of Salem, Massachusetts was torn apart by a series of witch trials that shook the colonial American world to its core. With over 150 people accused, innocent men and women were sent to the gallows in what stands as one of the most poignant examples of how fear and suspicion can turn a seemingly quiet community upside down. But how much of a role did witchcraft actually play? And can these events be explained away simply as human nature? On this episode, we discuss the Salem Witch Trials. Thank you for downloading this very special, and not so spooky, Halloween edition. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this very special Halloween edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. In Season 1 of the series, we're discussing the colonial frontiers of North America, the people and events that shaped it, and the places and ideas that changed its history forever. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, on my author's website, bradykreitzer.com, and of course, your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. On today's episode, we're taking a look at easily one of the most popular, controversial, and misunderstood topics in all of colonial American history. That is, of course, Salem and its vaunted witch trials. It is inevitable when you talk about colonial American history, particularly when the calendar gets around to the end of October, that this topic rears its ugly head. And while it is a bit out of the scope of Series 1, we certainly will be discussing some interesting frontiers in colonial America. Perhaps not physical frontiers, but certainly the frontiers of emotion, passion, power, economics, and politics. The Salem witch trials have always captivated American imagination. That's nothing new. Almost since the moment they've ended, people have looked back at them and wondered, how could such a travesty occur? How could the modern world in 1692 be driven to the brink of madness in such a way that dozens of people were killed and mass hysteria was able to reign across a colony? Well, on this episode, we're going to discuss the Salem Witch Trials, and we're going to see that there's very little spooky about this topic, but a great deal of very traceable and very predictable behavior at play. Now, if you're seeking the supernatural, if you're seeking the ghostly, if you're seeking the spiritual, this may not be the discussion for you. But if you're interested in where these events come from, and more importantly, what they tell us about the colonial American world, then Wartime Podcast is your place to be. Now, let's first talk about why the Salem Witch Trials seem to seep into all facets of American popular imagination. As I've mentioned earlier, it never fails. Even if you've never considered history, even if you've never considered the events that shaped our past, the Salem Witch Trials always seem to emerge as a point of interest. It seeps into literature, it seeps into film, it seeps into music. These events of 1692 and 1693 have left an indelible mark on the American popular conscience. And it makes you wonder, when will it go away? Will it ever go away? And will it ever stop being applicable to the modern world. The Salem Witch Trials gives us a wonderful insight, not only into colonial America, but into the mind of a population. It gives us a sense of how and why populations can operate, and just what role something like mass hysteria and fear and politics can play, and how ridiculous very sensible people can become, given the right circumstances. It's very clear to me, from my experience, that if you aren't hooked on history yet, the Salem Witch Trials are typically what will bring you in. Students will sleep their way through a lot of the first part of the class, but whenever we get to the Salem Witch Trials, they're hooked. Their attentions are grabbed. It might be because they're interested in hearing about spectral evidence, right? About the supernatural, about the great beyond. But as Ebenezer Scrooge famously said, there's more gravy than of grave about you. Think about the idea. There's an event that is driven by the romance and the fantasy of the devil all around you, of evil seeping into the world, of a group of people just seemingly minding their own business. Well, it's a romantic story, it's a fantastic story, and it's largely not an accurate story. But we'll discuss the Salem Witch Trials as historians do. It's a very fascinating story, it's a very interesting story, and it's probably not what you expect. But it's an excellent window into the time period that as historians, we rarely have the chance to experience. So before we can talk about these witch trials, let's again get a glimpse of the full picture. Remember, these do not happen in a vacuum. And while the events of 1692 and 1693 can appear to be mysterious, we must remember, as historians, we actually can extrapolate a much clearer picture, even over a subject that seems out of our reach, just by piecing together the larger narrative that surrounds it. So let's talk first about New England in the 17th century. What makes these people tick? Why do they do what they do? Why does this incredible witchcraft hysteria take place here and not, say, just a little bit farther south, like Pennsylvania, like New Jersey, or in Virginia? We need to explore New England in the colonial period a little further before any more of this can make sense. When we talk about the colonies of New England, we're talking about Massachusetts Bay, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Hampshire. This is what we see. And we have to understand that these are a very specific and very select group of individuals driven by an ideology that is largely not shared by the larger population of the English world. What originally brought them to the New World was this sense of what we would think of as today as religious fanaticism. These are not just your average members of the Church of England. These are an extremist Calvinist sect of people who believe the only way to truly practice their faith as they chose was in the blissful isolation of the New World. The Puritans, we called them. But the time period we're dealing with is the 1690s, and they've been in the New World for the better part of half of a century. And in that same time, they developed a very unique and very strict way of life that does not translate into other places in the New World or anywhere else in the English world. Religion for these people is everything. It's the lens in which they view the world. Their politics and their religion are one and the same. Their major political leaders are also, no surprise, major church leaders. The rules that govern them are typically rules that find their origins and justifications in the Old Testament of the Christian Bible. And we're not talking about Ten Commandments justifications. We're talking about very specific justifications that transform these people and their sense of law and justice into an almost Old Testament world. It's a male-dominated world, as the Old Testament prescribes. So, Everything about these people is based in religion, and that will implant a certain amount of specific traits that will allow something as seemingly far out as the Salem witch trials to emerge. Number one, they are not what we would consider an inclusive society. We always have this idea that the Puritans of the New World went to North America seeking religious freedom. But again, that's not necessarily reflected in the historical record. They're really seeking religious isolation. They don't want to be around other peoples. They don't want to perhaps absorb other people's cultural traits and values. They want to do what they want to do, and that's all. So what I'm saying is, Puritan New England is an incredibly introverted society. They have very little patience for outside perspectives, and they are naturally suspicious of anyone who is different than them. Now, we really need to take that to the nth degree to understand exactly how Puritan New Englanders view outsiders, because it's almost built in their cultural DNA to look at someone who doesn't look like them, doesn't sound like them, and doesn't worship like them, and view them not only as an outsider, but as an entire threat to their way of life. We can't stress that enough. And for them, again, the Bible is led in an extraordinarily literal way. They do not, for example, listen to music outside of a church setting. They believe that music is a vice, and to give in to your, perhaps, desires to hear a tune would be to allow all vice and therefore worldly sins into your world. Church for them is 2 to 3 hours per day, twice a week, Wednesday and Sundays, and you do not miss a sermon. They do not celebrate holidays like Christmas and Easter, because they believe they have their roots in pagan traditions. They do acknowledge the Christian doctrine behind those holidays, the birth of Christ and the rising of Christ on the third day, but they do not partake in the festivities, because again, they believe the festivities have their roots, and they're correct, in non-Christian ceremonies. So these are a people that are outliers even in their own time. They're conservative in an extremely conservative time. And that says a lot about them, because again, it's that built-in suspicion of people who are different than them, who are unlike them, that really guides a lot of their policies and a lot of politics. The Salem witch trials are really ignited from this underlying level of fuel that's been injected into this society seemingly from the beginning. When you look at families in New England, you also see this manifesting itself in that way. Children, by the age of 6, are expected to do the work in some way, shape, or form that adults will do. Boys will be outside working. Girls will be inside doing housework with their mothers, cooking, cleaning, sewing, you name it. The phrase, idle hands are the devil's workshop, really has its origins here in New England, because they believe that if children aren't working, if they aren't busy, then they are susceptible to what we'll call the invisible world. And to the people of New England, to the people of Salem, for example, the invisible world was a very real thing. It was all around them. They believe that surrounding you on a constant basis, 24 hours a day, there were demons, there were devils, and yes, there were spirits from beyond, but all of them, for the most part, sought to infiltrate your mind and inflict as much damage on your soul as possible. Now, a good Puritan man or a good Puritan woman could fend off their attacks. When we say these invisible beings surround you, they truly believe it. As plain as the sun comes up in the morning and the stars come out at night. They believe they are surrounded by evil all the time. They believe children are the most susceptible. It's why they must work and be diligent, because good Puritans can't fall victim to this evil that surrounds them. But If you begin to stray from the wisdom that the Old Testament provides, then you are, in fact, opening yourself to these evil spirits, and you can be what they would describe as afflicted. Now remember, they don't have microscopes. They don't have magnifying glasses. They can't see things like germs and microbes, so they simply don't know what they are. We have the benefit of technology. We can see these things, but we couldn't see them and therefore wouldn't understand them without the technology to do so. So we can't hold that against them. Remember, we're dealing with a culture 300 years older and therefore farther behind than ours. So they try to make sense of the world the best way they can. And the way they tend to do this is by or through supernatural means. Whenever someone becomes sick, whenever someone becomes ill, they have no sense that a microbe has entered their system and compromised it. So for them, this must be the evil manifesting itself in some way, or, even more troubling perhaps, a punishment from God for some sin that went unpunished. It's a very difficult world for us to understand, and it's not a viewpoint that translates well into the 21st century, but it's a very real one in New England in the 17th century. If that's just physical ailments we're talking about, dealing with things like influenza, dealing with things like smallpox, imagine how they considered something as bizarre, at least to them, as common mental illness today. Recent psychological figures show that something like 1 in 10 people has at one time or another suffered from a mental illness. And if that happens to you in 17th century Salem, then the explanation offered is likely not going to be very favorable for your recovery. It will always be viewed, like everything else in their society, through the lens of the spiritual, through the lens of the spectral. So we can see that a place like Boston and a place like Salem and any city throughout New England is ripe to be victimized by suspicion and fear driving their politics. The Salem witch trials, in many ways, couldn't have happened in other colonies because the way those other people viewed the world simply were not putting them into a position where witchcraft and curses were really viewed as an everyday part of their life, and therefore as something that could be adjudicated and legislated as you would any other law and any other crime at any other time. So let's talk about the Salem witch trials. We'll talk about the events. We'll talk about the major players. We'll talk about how this seemingly bizarre incident will spiral out of control and explode to a level that no one ever anticipated. We'll then talk about how historians view these events, what we interpret from these events, what we extrapolate from these events, what these events tell us about the conditions of colonial America in the 17th century. We are dealing with a frontier here, but it's a frontier of the mind. It's a frontier of the political world. We have two worlds coming together, the old world and the new, but they're going to manifest themselves in a very different way that with a trained eye, you'll gain an entirely new appreciation for. So let's first talk about the word on everyone's mind. When you hear the name of the town of Salem, it's the first thing you think of. I know that's true for me, and this is coming from a historian, so I know that it's probably true for you and most of the people you encounter and I encounter in our everyday lives. When you hear Salem, you think of one word, and that word is witch. If someone was claimed to be a witch today, it would not be our first instinct to burn them, or hang them, or punish them. I mean, think about this. In the last 4 years, in 2010, we had a major Senate candidate begin a campaign commercial by saying, "I am not a witch." It's Delaware. It's an amazing thing. But at any rate, it's still part of our lives. But where does the notion of a witch being a damnable and punishable event come from? Well, that actually comes not from America, but from Europe. Remember, The American colonies are English colonies, and they are an extension of a larger European world. By 1692, there is no sense that the people living in the New World are anything but English subjects. So, this is a very important point for us to understand. The ideas that will guide the events of 1692 in Salem and in other parts of Massachusetts are merely an extension, like every other idea, of the European world. In the 17th century, Europe is beginning to, what I describe as, wind out of a very terrible period of time that really began in about the 13th century, maybe earlier, and went all the way to, in some cases, the 19th century, where witches and witchcraft was something that was believed to be a criminal act and a part of everyday life. Tens of thousands of women, over a period of about 400 years, were executed in some of the most gruesome and terrible ways you could imagine for the crime of being a witch. They were burned, they were hung, they were stretched, they were drowned. You name it, the most creative and disturbing ways of killing someone, of executing someone, were used in Europe. So Europe has this natural affinity. In fact, for about four centuries, it was a political certainty used to maintain power, to gain power, and to keep power. It was governing by fear that witchcraft and witches were everywhere. It should be no surprise, then, that in 1692, in Massachusetts Bay Colony, that belief was there as well. So again, these events do not happen in a vacuum. They happen in a very interconnected world. I say it a lot, but the Atlantic Ocean is large. However, it's not large enough to stop the spread of ideas. Ideas will traverse that ocean as easily or more easily than any ship ever would. Let's get to 1692. Well, in Massachusetts, really in all of the colonies of New England, you're seeing that it's a time period of great tumult. For a period of about 30 years, you have this series of events, seemingly one after another, after another, after another, that leads to a very real sense of uncertainty and a very real sense of fear in New England, because power is uncertain. You don't know who's in charge. Therefore, you don't feel very safe in your own world. In 1684, back in England, politics of the empire will dictate that Massachusetts Bay will lose its colonial charter. Well, then you have one king replace another, and in 1691, they gain it back. But the issue is, they really effectively have to rebuild the colony in terms of laws, in terms of bureaucracy, in terms of systems, from the ground up. They have to reinstate basic mechanisms of control. Sheriffs, courts, you name it, district justices, things of all sorts that are just in place have to be reinserted when this new charter is finished. So the governor at the time has got a tall task. On top of that, in 1675, and this trickles all the way to 1692, New England is coming out of a very terrible and a very costly and a very bloody war against a number of native tribes in the region. It began with what we call King Philip's War in 1675. There were various incursions with the French in Canada, in which their Indian allies would invade and in many cases go to war with the people of New England. And again, tensions, we can say, for any number of reasons, are at an all-time high. People on New England collectively, as a society, are on edge. And there is this fear, there is this distinct sense that control and power and stability are something that you just don't have yet. And again, all of things will make the Salem witch trials a distinct possibility. It's really a collusion of a lot of very bad events that manifest themselves in this very bad way. So, let's talk about the events of 1692. It's important we first understand when we talk about Salem, we're actually talking about a much more complicated subject than we think, because Salem is effectively divided into two different towns at the time, or at least two different communities. There's Salem Town, that's the one we often think of. It's a coastal community. It deals in commerce from England and other parts of Europe. And then there's Salem Village, which is very different. It was, in a way, connected economically to Salem Town, but it's mostly a farming community. It's an agricultural community, and there are many instances of tension between these two groups for any number of reasons. So much so that the people of Salem Village actually sought their own ministers and their own local political officials separate from Salem Town. They viewed themselves as so different that the same person couldn't possibly represent both their interests at the same time. What you'll see is these two communities really in a push and pull battle in a lot of different ways. The election of religious figures, how very public events are handled. It's all part of the tension that exists before these witch trials ever begin to manifest themselves. Well, in the winter months of 1692, one figure is becoming increasingly controversial in the world of Salem, and his name is Samuel Parris. Samuel Parris is a minister, and he's not very popular. He does have support in the community amongst some people, but not all people. And one of the major complaints that's brought against Parris is the way he deals with seemingly personal issues. His way of resolving them is by making people's, again, in-house problems very public. So it should be no surprise that Parris is something of a well-known figure. Not well-liked, but everyone recognizes him. Well, in the winter of 1692, Samuel Parris's daughter Betty and her cousin Abigail begin to behave, as they say, very strangely. They have fits, they fall on the ground, they make scenes, they yell, they scream. They seem to be out of control of their own bodies. And again, we talked about how this would be viewed. Now, the natural inclination at the time is to say that this must be witchcraft. There must be something spectral, something supernatural at play here. And very quickly, three women from the community of Salem are arrested and brought to trial. The first is named Sarah Good. Sarah Good, in a lot of ways, fits the stereotypical profile of a person in European tradition that is singled out as a witch. She's homeless. She's viewed as a person without God in her life. She's viewed as a burden on the society. She makes a very convenient witch whenever you need one. The next person who's brought in for questioning is named Sarah Osborne. Sarah Osborne is a unique character because she also fits the mold of your perfect witch, but for different reasons. She's a widow, and she does something that rarely happens in the New England world. She remarries, and she remarries an indentured servant. In that way, many people in the community view her as a problem. Because here's a woman not content to live in the male-dominated society that Salem, that really all of New England, really is. She also makes another frowned-upon maneuver in 17th century New England when she tries to take the what we would think of as today as basic rights of inheritance from her late husband, rather than giving everything to her oldest son. Remember, New England is dominated from the male persuasion. So she would seemingly get nothing when her husband passed away. Her oldest son would get everything. Well, she had an issue with that. And today, from today's vantage point, rightfully so. But we're dealing with 1692 in Salem. So here you have a powerful woman, nothing is more threatening to a power structure than a woman who desires equality, or at least her fair share. The third person considered to be one of these witches afflicting the children is perhaps, I think, the most visibly susceptible person to accusation of witchcraft of them all. She's a slave from the Dominican Republic named Tituba. Now, Tituba has everything going against her in the world of Salem in 1692. She is not white. She is not born in England or New England. Her English is very broken. She is a slave. And she comes from a Caribbean world in which many believe to have this long tradition of practicing pagan or non-Christian rituals. So she makes an easy target for accusation in many ways. Tituba will be the first person that is questioned, and she actually will admit to her witchery. Now, we have the transcripts of these hearings, and we see a few things about them. Number one, you aren't immediately put on trial. Most of the transcripts we have from most of these events are from hearings. Her English is very broken. It appears to be a very intense interrogation, and she begins telling the people of Salem what they want to know, and this is not uncommon in all interrogation settings. Sarah Good and Sarah Osborne will both deny that they are witches, but Good will ultimately, as we say today, roll over on Osborne, claiming that she is the one performing all of this witchcraft. Tituba will verify that she is tormenting the children, but not because she wants to, because she's being made to. And you have the makings of a disaster in play. A lot of people like to say that these events of 1692, this original trial, is the spark that sets the house on fire, so to speak. But as you'll see when you study more and more historical events, we have a lot of sparks and we have a lot of fires. But that doesn't necessarily reflect the causal relationship. This may have been the spark that burned down the house if the house was already soaked in gasoline. And by soaked in gasoline, we're referencing all of the different cultural singularities and unusual features of New England life that we referenced earlier in the podcast. So here we have it. We have your first witch trial. These three women, all, as I've mentioned, very good candidates to be prospective witches, are put in jail. So what made them such good candidates in this way? Well, Sarah Good was homeless, Sarah Osborne was a widow, and Tituba was as much of an outsider as you could be in colonial New England. What they all have in common is that they have no one to defend them. And that's the key to finding your witch. That's the key to finding your scapegoat. Put someone on trial that garners no sympathy. Put someone on trial that no one will stand up for and no one will fight for. I think perhaps the most troubling thing, and this is a litany of troubling things, is that the Salem witch trials were not held in some cartoon circus court. There were legal protections in place. There were rights in place to ensure that you got a fair trial. And there was a number of methods and a number of steps that every accused person had to sort of work their way through. And all the while, each one failed them. Each one allowed the ludicrous notion that they were a supernatural being that was tormenting and torturing children to be acceptable and therefore punishable. So that's perhaps one of the most troubling things through all of this. And we'll see this happen many more times. The system is seemingly being implemented correctly, but the people who are involved, reasonable, logical, respectable members of New England society, are falling just as easily into the trap of hysteria that we'll eventually see play out. So, how much do we see? Well, again, as we've said, the trial that I just described was only the beginning because it set off a hysteria that would spread throughout the entire region. All told, when you consider the numbers that you see, this is what ends up in 1692 and 1693. 185 people were accused of being a witch in Salem. 141 of them were women. Of that number, 52 women and 7 men actually went to trial. 26 women and 5 men were convicted. 14 women and 5 men were put to death, executed, for being something that you can't possibly be, a witch. So where was this happening? Well, these final convictions were being distributed and handed out in what was known as the Court of Oyer and Terminer. That basically translates to hear and determine. And these were very much impromptu and seemingly temporary courts put in place by the colony of Massachusetts Bay just as a stopgap measure to deal with the basic inadequacies we've already discussed when they're trying to rebuild the bureaucracy and the systems of the colony. How does the madness end after all of that? It'll end whenever courts are forced to stop accepting what we call spectral evidence. That is, evidence of something you can't see, of something that is supernatural. And suddenly, when that evidence is no longer admissible in court, the story changes very dramatically. Within 10 to 15 years of the end of these witch trials, you'll see formal apologies coming out from prominent members of Salem society who handed out some of these punishments. These are, again, logical, reasonable people who, for any number of reasons, were sucked into this utter hysteria that gripped the countryside for the better part of a year. Now, that's the basic story. We don't have time to go into every court case or the way these people were executed, mostly hanging, one man pressed to death with rocks and weights to elicit a confession, which he didn't give. But what's more important for us is, what does this all mean? What will it tell us about people of the time period? Well, there's a few different ways you can view these events. The first is probably the easiest. All of these people were actually witches. All of the people who were afflicted actually were cursed. And justice was served when those people were put to death. Again, it's the easiest, it might be the sexiest, but it's not the approach that historians will take, and it's certainly not the approach we're going to talk about. Remember, this is a story of frontiers, of groups of people coming together and interacting in ways that will define both of them. So let's talk about the Salem hysteria, as historians will. Remember, we mentioned already that Salem itself wasn't just Salem. It was actually two different communities, Salem Town, the coastal urban group, and Salem Village, an agricultural rural group. Well, they don't get along. They never have gotten along. And to throw that information out, and that was a fact of life for the decades leading up to the witch trials, does a disservice to the topic. Why would they start liking each other when they've been at odds, when they've been opposed for all of this time? That is still very much a part of this story. The approach that it will take comes from an economic element, at least the interpretation that I subscribe to. The people of Salem Town and the people of Salem Village have a very rocky relationship, to say the least. It's viewed this way. The people of Salem Village, largely an agricultural community, spend all of their years farming. They grow food. Some of it is for their family, but most is to be sold to buyers elsewhere. Now, how do they sell it? Well, they sell it to the people in Salem Town, a coastal commercial community. The people in Salem Town will then take those crops and those goods, and they'll sell them to merchants coming in from the Atlantic Ocean. Now, the people of Salem Town, again, pay one certain sum to the farmers themselves, and then they resell the goods at a much higher profit. Now, we know this is the essence of capitalism, but there's a very real sense in Salem Village that in some way the farmers who are doing most of the physical labor are getting the raw end of the deal. So there's a natural dislike, largely driven by the economics and the market conditions of the region. When you look at all of the Salem witch trials, and again, the overwhelming thing about this is how the people justified it through the existing legal system, you'll see that we have a great number of details left. Who were the accusers and who were the accused? Where did they live? What did they say? It's all there. And when you lay it out on a map, you see a very incredible thing. Most of the accusers, those who said they were being tormented by witches, lived in the countryside. They lived in Salem Village. Most of the accused, those who were supposedly the witches, lived in Salem Town. The information had always been there, but no one ever just put it on a map until a book came out called Salem Possessed. And I'd encourage you to read it because it takes very disturbing, seemingly fantastical events and makes them all very human. So in the simplest way, it's the old city mouse versus country mouse dispute we still have. And in accusations of witch trials and witchery and witchcraft, the country mouse got his revenge. But could it really be that easy? Could it really be that simple? These events were so large. These events were so overwhelming. Well, in a lot of cases, as you'll see, the simplest answer, all things being equal, is usually the right one. Thank you for joining us. Happy Halloween. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.